We welcome you to another live edition of the Sports Box, brought to you by our sponsor, Showcase Sports in Hamilton. Showcase Sports for the elite athlete. And by our friends over at CrowdPlay. Download the free CrowdPlay app today and check them out at www.crowdplayapp.com for details. Ladies and gentlemen, it's showtime.
Hey everybody, welcome to the new edition of Cage My IQ. I am your host, D-Bake. I'm joined with me by my buddy, Jay, aka MMA Drunky. I'm actually going to have him get things started if you want to get things going.
Listen, man, I'm stoked for this. There's no other way to put it. And, you know, as I journey into my potential future as a podcaster, you know, and someone who genuinely loves to share his love for mixed martial arts in every way possible, you know, my motivation to do this, you know, is because of this man that we're about to talk to. And the amount of respect that I have for this certain individual is what drives me, you know, to want to become the best that I can, you know, in podcasting. But first, I do want to say, Daniel, Cage My IQ, thank you so much for allowing me to be a part of this. I mean, you're giving me the platform to be able to talk to this man. And, you know, I've never done an interview before, but I told myself that if I could have it anyway, I'd want my first MMA interview to be with someone that I have the utmost respect for, you know, and not just me, but MMA fans all around the world. So I took a chance, you know, go big or go home. And I reached out to him, you know, not really expecting nothing. And to my surprise, within a few hours, he was so gracious and he responded back in kind, agreeing to the interview. And I can't begin to tell you how stoked I am with you, Daniel, to have the privilege of just picking his brain and learning more about him. So it's without further ado that I have the unique opportunity to introduce someone who I believe is the heart of the UFC broadcast, the man who, in a short time, in my opinion, who has surpassed all as the greatest commentator in combat sports, and the man that I respect the most in the UFC. Ladies and gentlemen, after what sounded like a whole bunch of ass kissing, welcome in, John Anik.
Oh, what a pleasure to be with you boys. I mean, that's a lot to live up to, I'll tell you that. But Jay Henry knows how to book a podcast guest. If anybody's out there listening, if you need a talent booker, Jay Henry's your podcast. No, I appreciate sincerely everything you have to say, and I wish you all the best in this endeavor, obviously. But we were talking a little bit before the show. You know, I try to get to as many podcast-type interviews as I can, but candidly, you know, unlike when I was maybe getting started doing MMA stuff 10, 15 years ago, you know, I can't do them all. But obviously your message really resonated with me, and it's great to chop it up with you boys today.
Thanks for having being on.
Yeah, I mean, the pleasure's all mine, you know. Well, let's just get this thing kicked off here. So, I mean, I know this is probably the first question that you probably get in every interview, but just tell us what, you know, tell us the beginning of your journey. Tell us what got you into mixed martial arts. What made you want to become a broadcaster?
Well, I grew up in a big sports town, you know, just outside of Boston, Massachusetts. And that was sort of what laid the foundation for me wanting to work in sports. But, you know, back then, it wasn't just the multimedia age. You know, I was just trying to be a newspaper writer back then. You know, I remember my first newspaper story in 2001, getting $25 to write the article. By the time you pay taxes, you know, you're cleaning like 16 right. bucks. Right. And it takes, you know, 5 hours. It's like, wait a second, making like $3 an hour, but my name's in the newspaper. That sort of eventually I was able to migrate towards radio. You know, I did go back to school to the Connecticut School of Broadcasting, which allowed me to get an internship at a sporting news radio affiliate in Boston. And that's sort of what allowed me to get some much needed repetitions. You know, Jay, even in our brief conversations, you know, off the air, repetitions are the key to anything, you know. And some people say, oh, you know, how do you do this or how do you navigate this? It's like, well, I don't really know, but I'm 42 now. I look up at the calendar. I called my first MMA fight in 2009. So a lot of it's just experience and learning and failing and all of those things. But thankfully, I've had people believe in me at different times along my journey. And thankfully, to whatever degree, I've been ready for opportunities. So when I have auditioned, whether it was on ESPN radio to be an update guy or to call an MMA fight, you know, I've been ready enough to get the shot.
Well, absolutely. And like you said, you grew up in, you know, you came from Boston. Tell me, what was it like growing up in Boston? I'm from Mississippi. I live in Oregon now. I live in Pennsylvania whenever I was a kid, but I didn't really remember it. But what was it like, you know, growing up in Boston?
So the only times I really remember going into the city were to see the Red Sox or see the Celtics or the Bruins or to go see theater, you know? So I was in the Metro West area, but even though my dad was from New York, my mom's side of the family, they were such impassioned sports fans that whether I liked it or not, you know, that was going to be part of the fabric of my life. You know, there was one TV, it was black and white, I think, for a part of my childhood. And it was on the Celtics and Larry Bird, whether I liked it or not. So in a lot of respects, I think you're born into sports living in that region.
Absolutely.
But I have just such fond memories of the whole state. I mean, I lived in 7 or 8 different parts of Massachusetts. And obviously, I think a lot of us sort of wear our fanaticism loud and proud being from New England. And, I think for me, thankfully, it crystallized in me probably 15, 16 years old that I wanted to work in sports, because the later you sort of find that passion or figure out what you want to do, I think it makes it harder. So thankfully, from a pretty young age, I was like, I don't know, man, whatever I do, hopefully sports can be a part of it.
If you weren't a broadcaster, what do you think you'd be doing?
Well, I mean, I used to work with autistic children. I used to be a vocational coordinator. So I did like job coaching and job placement for autistic teenagers and things like that. And it's funny, I was just having this conversation with my wife about how, you know, teachers just don't make enough money. And I'd probably still be doing that, but I wasn't making enough money. And I was like, man, you know, how am I going to support a family doing this? You know, I didn't have a degree in special education. And right. But no, it would definitely be working with special needs kids for sure.
Well, you followed me back a couple months ago, and it was basically because I mentioned MMA Live. I don't know if that's like a trigger or anything like that. But yeah, I can remember way back then. I didn't actually watch the show. I had the clips. They popped up on my Xbox. So that's the way that I was able to see them, man. And just seeing you then, I knew you were probably destined for greatness. It's just I'm not trying to kiss you, you know, just the way that you speak and your transitions and just, I mean, it was phenomenal. And I knew that you were destined for greatness. I'm curious, I know you, when you left ESPN, you came to the UFC, you were working usually on the Fox shows and stuff like that. Tell me what it felt like whenever you got the call and were told that you were going to be, you know, replacing Mike Goldberg and just someone as iconic as him.
Well, I'll never forget the moment we were behind the TV trucks. It was the eve of another show that we were doing. And one of the bosses, I won't drop a name here out of respect to this individual, but he let me know that, you know, the company was moving in the direction that they were moving. And, you know, it's hard. And I hope that, you know, certain people don't take this the wrong way, but I never would have left ESPN in Bristol if I did not think that that I could ascend to that number one seat. Now, I had no grand visions as to when it was going to happen, but I felt like if I worked hard and I continued to get better, that I could be the number one guy and call the title fights and be a part of those historical moments to whatever degree. And it happened sooner than I thought it would, for sure, but I felt ready. You know, I felt as good as anybody in the MMA space, as humbly as I can say that. So but yeah, man, I just remember just putting my hands on my knees and be like, man, you know, because anytime I think you make a big decision in life, you know, you consider all sides, and it's not that you allow doubt to creep in, but there was a time when I almost left ESPN for Bellator, and I didn't end up leaving. I did Bellator season 1, and then I didn't leave ESPN to do season 2 because most people advising me were telling me I would have been crazy to leave ESPN, when at the time my heart was already in MMA. I wanted to go to Bellator season 2. I didn't care about hosting, you know, Sports Center. One thing led to another. I stayed at ESPN and it worked out. But very thankful to have the seat. And as you guys have probably heard me say, I got to earn it next weekend.
And you answered my next question. I was just going to ask if there was a time back then, you know, where you actually got discouraged, where you got to a point where you thought, you know, I might not make it. You know, but you already answered that question. You know, it's amazing. It's just amazing to see, you know, people's vulnerabilities, I guess you would say, someone who, you know, or in a spot like yours where maybe they got discouraged but didn't give up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, like, I remember being at ESPN, I don't know, 2009, 2010, and I wasn't getting any play-by-play opportunities. I would get a college football game here or there. You know, I remember the date of a college football game, September 24, 2011, tells you I haven't called that many football games. So I had a hard time getting football opportunities.
Right.
So when the UFC came calling, and I, as I understood it when I got hired, I was going to be calling half of their live events. You can understand why it had appeal for more reasons than one. So that was probably the biggest moment of discouragement once I was on the path. Right. But it was like, here I am in Bristol, and I couldn't get a shake doing a live event. But thankfully, I'm in the live event space now, because that's really the real adrenaline kicker for me with respect to the studio work. I just love doing the live shows.
That's amazing to hear. Hey, Daniel.
You mentioned that you're a very big Boston fan being up there. I kind of know how that is. I'm a Red Sox fan in myself.
Yes.
And my dad got me into them. Everything else, I'm a Philly fan through and through. But with baseball, I'm a Red Sox fan. Who's your favorite Red Sox player of all time?
Can you see Nomar Garciaparra with a bat? There it is. If you guys are watching on video, you can see that.
Yeah.
Well, he's probably my favorite Red Sox. And there was a time where I was a fanatic. I mean, fanatical about the Red Sox. When I first got out of college, I mean, I probably watched 145 games one summer. Now, mixed martial arts has ruined a lot of these sports for me. I follow the Red Sox. I read the box scores, but I watch very few innings, you know, but I will always have a soft spot for the Boston Red Sox. You can be sure.
Yeah. My favorite is Dustin Pedroia, just how he played before he got hurt so many years. Small guy, but he had the heart of a champion.
No doubt.
And he hit like he was big. He was just like the heart of the team for so long, even with David Ortiz there. I just gravitated towards him, and then I got to see him a lot of times, like when they would play at Citizens Bank here in Philadelphia. And I actually got a chance to see him in Fenway. I've been to Fenway twice. I think the second time was when they retired David Ortiz's number. I got to see him there. And he was just my favorite. Like, yeah. I don't know. I don't know why. Maybe it's just because of him having so much heart.
Probably.
Yeah, but moving on, how do you think journalism has evolved in the past 20 years from then to now?
It's crazy. It's crazy to see where the industry is. And I think in some respects it's in a good place, and in some respects it's in an unfortunate place. You know, I sit here and I look at a newspaper article of mine from 2001, and it's like, fuck, I'm old, right? But 20 years, and I remember how hard I fought to see my name in a newspaper. And now I just think there's just a lot of egos. And I think there's too much of a focus on even, you know, trying to break the news electronically. There's just a lot of issues. And I think workforce wise, it's very hard to sit up on a podium as I did teaching at the Connecticut School of Broadcasting and telling people to go into a career in journalism because of how cutthroat it is and political it is. And, you know, I'm a little bit desensitized to certain parts of the industry, and I don't intend to sit up here and be pessimistic about it, but I think you guys can understand it's a very hard space to be in. And, you know, even launching a podcast, right? It's like, you know, it's not like I'm crushing it financially on my podcast, but you can be sure every Monday we're pushing out a show, you know,
yeah.
And that's the focus, you know, and that I think is what keeps me going, you know, but I also too am not your prototypical journalist, right? Like you could call me a promoter. I mean, technically the day I started working for the UFC, you turn in the journalism card and you're essentially a promoter. So I like being a promoter in a lot of respects, but, I do look forward to a day at some point where I get to put that journalistic hat, you know, back on a little bit more.
What is it like to prepare for fight night? I know you have a very big, from what I heard, a very big preparation where you try and like ask all the fighters several times what their name is, because you want to say it right. You don't want to mess it up. How's preparation like?
It's a beast, you know. I get anxious just getting asked that question, honestly. You know, I have a fighter card library behind me of God knows thousands of fighters, and my system probably a little bit antiquated, but I handwrite all of my fighter cards. It's a pretty extensive process, but it allows me to sort of study in an old school way, not on like flashcards, forcing yourself to write things out. Hopefully some of them are committed to memory, but you know, there's a lot of film study as I'm taking notes. I certainly will have film on. We have fighter meetings with probably 16 of the 24 athletes on every card. And that's a big part of the preparation and the big part of the fight week focus. And then there's just a lot that goes into the show format and formulaics. When we're going to a break, like a lot of people think we're just, you know, all right, coming up next, you know, Jay Henry taking on D-Bake, we'll be right back. Whereas we're trying to maximize those 30 seconds and tell you, you know, that Jay Henry's from Mississippi, but he spent some time in Pennsylvania. You know, we're trying to maximize that. And the way you do that is, you know, writing for television, being prepared. And, you know, there's a lot of different things that go into a live event. We don't just show up and talk, as a lot of people think is the case.
Right.
Is it true that you learned quite a bit from Mauro Ranallo? Because when I see both of you guys separately, you guys have like the same style, I feel like, with how Karn, like you guys put your voice out there. You want to make sure you're heard. And you guys both like present the commentator booth in a way that's very detailed.
I love Mauro Ranallo. I mean, I remember when I was first cutting my teeth as an MMA play-by-play guy, I was always putting him over and putting him on the pedestal that he deserves to be on, quite frankly. He is a special mind and a special man. And, you know, hopefully some of his style has rubbed off on me a little bit. You know, I've tried to learn from anybody, you know, my contemporaries before me, during me, after me. You know, I've never had a perfect show. We're always trying to be better. But stylistically, it's certainly flattering to draw a comparison to a guy that I hold in such high regard.
Yeah, I can definitely tell, like, when you guys talk, you guys are showing your emotion out there. Even though you're not in the octagon, you guys are showing how you're feeling at the time by your reaction, which is great. Like, I watch you in UFC, and then I was watching him in NXT, and it's just like I could tell that there were similarities in you two, and you guys are two of my favorite.
Well, thank you. That's cool to hear. Thank you.
Yep. Here's a good question that I had. How was it to being able to call Khabib's debut and then also his retirement?
Man, it's just crazy to think about everything that went into the first time we ever called UFC fights. If you're looking at that picture on the left, January 20th, 2012, it was the first night that I ever called UFC fights. And I look at that guy, it's like, I don't even know that kid, right? I see my arm around another kid, Khabib, and we were just trying to get through that show, you know? And I guess when I look back at it in retrospect, I think, man, I mean, I knew Khabib was going to be good, right? Because I did have a meeting with Joe Silva before we called fights, and he was like, hey, look out for this Dagestani, because he could be something special. So we knew he could be great, but I think about what our preparation entails right now compared to what it was then. And it's like, oh God, how did we even go to air doing it that way? So we've evolved over 10 years a lot, but certainly special for me to be in there with him that night. And then to be in there when he capped it at 29-0. Yeah. I mean, bookend wise, that's as special as anything that I've ever been a part of career wise. So thankful to get the chance. You know, anytime I get a chance to do a post-fight interview, I'm very thankful to have that opportunity.
What was your most memorable moment calling in UFC history?
Oh, man. So, yeah, it's tough. Yeah. Right? And I guess, you know, it's like, so as you might expect, it's not the first time I've been asked that question, right? So oftentimes I find myself thinking, so do I switch it up and just give love to different fights, or do I just have one token answer that, but I got to say, the first thing that always comes to mind is Thug Rose, Nama Yunus, knocking out Joanna Jędrzejczyk the first time, because I hold Joanna in such high regard as a champion and future UFC Hall of Famer. And her championship reign is as good as any. I mean, Amanda Nunes is the GOAT, but what Joanna did in establishing that division and her greatness is so special that to see Rose, you know, wipe some of it out with a knockout like that, And then to have see saying Thug Rose, the way he said it.
It's hard for me to think about iconic, man.
Any other moment.
What are some of your hobbies outside of the UFC, like that you do at home just to keep your mind away from it, just enough time for you to not be too entrenched in MMA?
Yeah, I mean, I like to play golf. I'm not that good, but I'm trying to get better. I like to play basketball whenever I get the chance. Man. Play a little tennis here and there, but it's hard to find a willing partner. You know, I wouldn't say that running and working out is a hobby, but I do it because I have to fit into a tiny little suit and go on television. But I wouldn't hobby is like a positive word. So I wouldn't say that running is a hobby. It's an inconvenient truth of my life, I guess. But candidly, I got 3 kids, 9 and under. So a big part of my day is immersed in them and that. And most days I'd have it no other way.
Yeah, I got 3 kids, 11, 7, and 15 months. So
yep. I got 2, 7 and 9.
We're
about the same age. Yeah. I'm 41. You're 42, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, sounds about right.
Yeah, it's definitely crazy. I got all boys, so like they got me running around in different directions.
What about you, Jay?
What's that?
Girls, boys.
I have a boy. He's 9, and I have a daughter who's 7. They are the best of siblings. I couldn't ask for 2 better kids in the world. Wow. I mean, I know I'm just – people say those just because you're kids. No, honestly, I've never seen a brother and sister have a bond like my kids, especially with everything that we've been through in the past year and a half. They are so strong. I mean, they're just so amazingly strong for their age. And, you know, like I said, I couldn't ask for, you know, for better kids.
That's really cool to hear.
Yeah, I like seeing the different personalities. The oldest one, he's mellow. The middle one's the problem child. He's the out there, and then the baby's definitely showing his unique personality now. How he likes to talk a lot.
Yeah,
he's not afraid, but then he has that little shy side around certain people. So he's showing like a little bit of both of the older boys.
Good. He's a good. Hopefully, he'll be the right mix. You know, finally get it right on attempt number 2.
Do you live in Vegas?
No, so I lived in Vegas for about 5 years. I live in South Florida now.
Okay.
Since late 2014. And it's really just because my mom's down here. My family's down here. I was going to Brazil a lot at the time. So it just made sense. But obviously in this COVID climate, I wish I was in Vegas because it's been a lot of traveling, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
Well, at least next month, you don't have to travel that far to Jacksonville.
Yeah, I'm excited. Just rent a car.
I'm so excited for that card.
Oh, it's going to be sick.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I got family in Jacksonville, so which is nice. So I think I'm going to try and get down there.
Nice.
Just to catch the atmosphere.
Yeah, cool.
Well, hey, I want to ask this question because I don't want us to run out of time or anything. This is probably the most important question that I had to ask today. And how fucking scary is Francis Ngannou?
Bro. Scary is probably the most appropriate adjective, right? Because more so than any fighter that I've been cage side commentating, there's just this cloud of anticipation, and it's not always good anticipation, right?
Yeah.
Good if you're Team Ngannou, but just the concern as to what type of catastrophic event might transpire, because he really is such a unique athlete, and it's hard not to think about somebody like LeBron James, right? Who is naturally, you know, 6'8", 258, right? Heavyweight division would be perfect for a guy like that. And Francis's frame and physical gifts are such that he should be favored over any man in that division, including John Jones, who I think is the greatest mixed martial arts athlete of all time. So the fact that he's been able to channel things in the right way, the fact that he has been coachable, the fact that work ethic hasn't been a problem. I'm so happy that he realized his dreams, because I know you guys could probably attest, having watched a lot of his UFC career, a lot of people are surprised it took him 13 fights to become the UFC champion, right?
Yeah.
Because of the physical gifts. Like, you look at the guy and you feel like, really? He's fighting this dude from Ohio? Like, he's going to smash this, right? And obviously there's a lot more that goes into it. And now Francis loves all the more that goes into it. And you see the results.
Yeah, I mean, it was really tough for me when we did the podcast the other night and we started talking about it. It was probably the most emotional I've ever gotten on a podcast, as far as just because, I mean, even though Stipe lost, it's hard not to be extremely happy for both of those guys. You know what I mean? I mean, Stipe embodies, you know, what you ask for in a champion. I think he is one of the most underappreciated fighters in UFC history. But Francis Ngannou has been my favorite fighter for, you know, going on 4 years now. Even when he lost to Stipe, I was still behind him, you know, and I was really hoping that, you know, he would pull it all together. And I just, you know, I was just curious to know how fucking scary is he? Does he have like that aura where it's absolutely frightening?
Absolutely. And you're right to, you know, put some shine on Stipe, because it's crazy to think that you could be like the greatest MMA heavyweight of all time and yet somehow still be underappreciated, right? Mm-hmm. How does that work? Because the three of us and everybody else constantly putting him over as the greatest, and yet somehow he's still underappreciated, but it does feel that way. So any shine that he can get, I am all for. But yes, Ngannou is the most imposing power puncher that has ever graced that canvas. And candidly, I don't know that you get much of an argument from people, right? I mean, you can talk about Rumble Johnson, you can talk about Derek Lewis, but Ngannou is just a level up, with all due respect.
Yeah, we were talking about the other day how Stipe, and I think the 4 or 5 title defenses, was the underdog in all but one of them. And it's like, how do you have a guy that embraces that heavyweight a division so much like he did, where he broke the record for defenses in a row, and then keep on making him the underdog. And then he just did it really well. And then he carried the division when the division wasn't at its best.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I a lot of people were sort of, you know, barking up that tree, Stipe's the underdog, and he has been. You're absolutely right on the numbers, but the numbers have been close in a lot of these fights. And one thing I would say is like, well, when you're giving up 30 pounds in a division, you're probably going to be the underdog, you know? Like, so now granted, in other fights, he wasn't giving up that much weight, you know, against Fabricio Verdum or, you know, but he's an undersized heavyweight. On that, I think we can all agree. So I'm not all that surprised. Like, there's reasons why he's the underdog. And when he is, it's not as though he's some massive underdog. Right. You know, I thought he should have been the dog against Francis. And obviously, there were a lot of pro fighters and other people betting on him, so it didn't get as pronounced as I thought it would get. But, you know, Francis is a bad man.
How far are we away from you and your brother in MMA fight?
Ha, me and my twin brother. We'll see. You know, hopefully, you know, in a few years, it'll actually be something that people want to watch, and maybe we can
with
do something clarity. But I got to keep building a profile, and I also got to train a little bit. You know, I'm getting in pretty good shape in terms of the strength and conditioning, but I need some skill development time. But just having a little fun on the Instagram, and it kind of took on.
Yeah,
a life.
I loved when you said that. You were like, yeah, fighting my brother with headgear.
Yeah. Well, hey. I mean, I got to be ready, because all I have to do is sort of posture a little bit and joke about a possible amateur fight. And the next thing you know, I got, you know, 50 fight offers from amateur bantamweights around the world. So you got to be careful out there.
Now, are you guys all business, like right before you're getting ready to go live? Or are you guys just cutting jokes and just staying loose?
It's a great question. It's a little bit of a mix of both. I mean, there's some rehearsal that goes on leading up to showtime, and then he might be like, all right, you got 5 minutes. So certainly when I put the cans down and I have 5 minutes, you know, it's loose. You know, obviously if everything is going right in your personal life, that makes it a little bit easier, you know. Not to say that you're perseverating over those things right before you go on the air, but yeah, we try to keep it loose, and it's hard because we have a very demanding boss, you know, but we try to keep it as loose as humanly possible before we crack a mic.
How do you feel about getting back to calling the action in front of fans?
I mean, are we just video, or because I think just put my hands together and thank the heavens is all you need to see. There are some conveniences to calling fights in the UFC Apex, right? There's no doubt about it that we waste a lot of time in transit when we're working, right? Going from the host hotel to the Toyota Center in Houston and going for the official weigh-in and the ceremonial weigh-in. And so, yeah, the UFC Apex is very convenient. It allows us to maximize time. We can very easily communicate and coordinate with our staff. But my gosh, the fans are the lifeblood of this sport. And as a play-by-play guy, who doesn't want 15,000 screaming lunatics behind him, you know?
Yeah, as long as they're not throwing beer.
I mean, I hesitate to call it a crutch, but like, yeah, man, like, give me the goddamn fans. April 24th, let's go.
I know. I was watching a meme. I was going to put it on here, but it wouldn't let me. It was a knockout, and it was you guys with the fans behind you. I think it was you, Cormier, and Rogan, and you guys were just going crazy, and then you see you pan to the right, calling the action still while Cormier's falling on top of Joe Rogan, and then you see the fans just going crazy. And nothing beats that. Nothing beats that, because when it's no crowds, like, it's great, but you lose some of the nostalgia with the reactions.
Yeah, your reactions are the best. I'm sorry. Yeah, you know, everybody wants to see your guys' reactions, and they're amazing.
It's sort of weird, right? Because especially as a play-by-play guy, and thankfully they've been showing the DC single cam the most because of his reactions are just absolutely epic. But it's sort of weird, right? Because people obviously, like, that resonates with people. But at the end of the day, like, we're just announcers. And especially as a play-by-play guy, you know, I'm trying to blend in, you know? So, but it is what it is. They have the camera on us, you know, and I try not to think too much about it when I'm but dude, sometimes you just look like a total clown when those things get repurposed, but it is what it is.
Yeah, luckily for you, you're the one that is calling it at the time. Huh. So then they usually pan, like you said, to Rogan and Cormier, and then you see Cormier just go like this,
right?
Because he's so in shock, and then he almost falls over on the Rogan, and then you just see you like yelling because you're trying to get the reaction out over the crowd. It's just amazing. I just love every second of it.
It's crazy how that image has just taken off to such an extent. You know, I mean, I can't tell you how many times artists have sent me renditions. You see one of them right there from that moment. Yeah, pretty cool.
Who's that, Max? And
oh, that's a different one. Max and Calvin Kattar, that's a new one.
Yeah, I was trying. I didn't think of it being Calvin Kattar. I
tried to cover up Kattar getting bludgeoned, right? Cover up my Boston guy getting bludgeoned, right? If I sit right there, cover up my guy. Sorry, Cal. Love you. Love you, Cal.
Go ahead.
Yeah, one of my last questions before I take it right back to Jay. Who do you think's the next star of the UFC if he had to give a name?
So, recency bias aside, I believe Sean O'Malley is one of the best bantamweights in the world. I think what works against him is the division. It's just so hard. But I do believe he's ready to take his shots at that division's elite. You know, I'm excited to see what Miranda Maverick can do in the women's flyweight division for sure. I think she's ready for top five competition now. Sure. So those are two names that come to mind. And, you know, Chris Gutierrez looked really good in his last fight. You know, I still think Chito Vera could make a run. Ricky Simone, Merab Dwalishwili, a lot of bantamweights, but the future is bright, needless to say.
I don't know what it is, but I just have a good feeling about Sean Brady with what he's done lately.
I mean, we almost need to go division by division with that question, but yeah, Sean Brady's a beast. He's built like the side of a backyard shed.
Yep. Well, I only have a couple more questions. Well, two questions. My first one's going to be a hypothetical, and it's going to be kind of, you know, off the wall. And it's just because of me, and, you know, I'm the kind of guy who just tries to put matchups together. So, yeah, I mean, Israel Adesanya, he looks like he's probably going to be ruling the middleweight division for a long time. You know, if you look at that 2-10, not a lot of people are giving, you know, people too much credit. Now, I'm going to throw out a couple hypothetical fights of people that aren't in the middleweight division, but could possibly happen. I want to know what you would think. My first one is Israel Adesanya versus Luke Rockhold.
I love it. I was reading some comments from Luke today, and a motivated Luke Rockhold is a real problem. Jay, I will tell you though, it's a really hard weight cut for him.
Yeah.
And
but he wants to do it. He says he does, right?
No doubt. No doubt. And far be it from me to put it past him. But that can't be discounted when it comes to the Rockhold equation, because, you know, when he fought Romero, I mean, and granted that was back, you know, that was a, we did the weigh in, like where they showed up on weight and had to wait in the arena. But I just remember it being just horrifying seeing him just sitting there in the arena, just looking like he just needed to move up a weight class.
Does anybody in 185 have a worse weight cut than Luke Rockhold?
You know, I mean, I, you know, it was never easy for Chael. It was never easy for Bisping, any of those guys back in the day. But no, I think for Luke, I mean, the way he's built, it's really hard for him. So again, I'm as excited as you are for Rockhold, but I didn't mean to bring it down with like a
No, no, no. I just wanted to throw out like a hypothetical.
But I love that fight, and Luke's an athlete. You know, like I love how convicted he is in believing that he can smash these dudes.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, with Izzy, I just try to think of fighters that I think can beat him, and I don't really see too many in the middleweight division that, you know, they can contend, but I don't think they could get over on. Luke Rockhold is one of those guys, and my other guy. And these are, they would just be a spectacle of a fight. My other one would be Stephen Wonderboy Thompson.
Love it. Absolutely love it. Yeah, I can see no real downside to that. And again, a guy in Stephen Wonderboy Thompson who does not have an easy cut down to 70 or 71. So, right. Yeah, I see a lot of upside to that matchup for sure.
Sorry, I know that was just kind of hypothetical. But
no, I like that.
So did you have one more thing, Dan?
Yeah, I just want to ask with Luke Rockhold, what do you think of the rumor that about Khabib wanting to train him?
So I often wondered with Khabib, so, and it seems like he is now retired with finality, but I thought maybe he would come back in like 3 years. Right. Because whatever itch competitively he was trying to scratch, he couldn't do so by just coaching. But I think he really enjoys coaching and cornering, and it allows him to stay in the game a little bit. And if anybody can coach up Luke Rockhold and get him in a position to beat a guy like Adesanya, my money's on Khabib. So I love hearing that. You know, those guys are supremely tight, as you guys know.
That's awesome. Well, yeah, my final question would just be, you know, what would your advice be for, you know, guys like us, guys who are podcasters, you know, trying to make a way? What would your piece of advice be for, you know, upcoming broadcasters like us who, you know, honestly look at you as a role model and strive to be like you?
Well, I appreciate it very much. And it's great to be on with you guys tonight. You know, I would say it depends what your goals are. If your goals are strictly monetary, that's different than if you just want to improve your quality of life, have a platform, and hopefully have it become some sort of financial conduit for you. You know, I've been doing our podcast for almost 6 years. I can assure you nobody's getting rich on it. Not even Kenny Florian, who's the highest paid guy on the show, you know?
Right.
So it depends what your goals are, but to be consistent, to be in the space, you have to be weekly, if not biweekly, you know, like in a perfect world, right? If people want the content, you know, you're Monday through Friday, right? And they can wake up to get in the car and they can turn you on, you know? Sure. So that's something that we've battled with, is that we haven't been able to go twice a week. So, but we've gone once a week, committedly, consistently for 6 years. So first I would say you just have to be committed. You have to be consistent. And it doesn't really matter what your listenership is for a while, you know. Obviously you don't want to be losing numbers, you know, but sure, focus on the content, focus on the platform, and the rest will take care of itself, you know. But there is absolutely no substitute for the repetitions that you get by doing it weekly. And if you do it for a year, you look up, you got 50 shows in the can, you're off and run.
Yeah, John. I've definitely gotten a little bit better each time I've done it, because I started only probably 3-4 months ago, and I've noticed the difference then to now.
Oh yeah,
just like you said, with getting, even if it's a little bit better each show, you're at least putting the work in, and then you're gonna get to the point where it's just second nature.
Right, exactly.
And I'm just someone who loves to talk, you know. Yeah, and especially when it's MMA, and I mean, it's just like I said, it's become my outlet, you know, my main outlet over this past, you know, year and a half, and you know, I love it, man. Hey, John, thank you so much, man. You really, really, really made my day today, and I can't thank you enough.
My pleasure to be on with you, boys. And Jay, you got a direct line, man. You know where to find me if you guys need anything. And we'll do it again sometime. But I wish you guys all the best. And we will talk to you from a distance, I guess, in about 10 days on ABC.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Thanks, boys.
Yep. Now, that is the end of the interview. We would like to thank John Anik so much for coming on. He's an iconic commentator in the world of mixed martial arts. Do you have anything to say before we get going, Jay?
Listen, man, I had the utmost respect for you and giving me the opportunity. I know when you said I could start being on the podcast from time to time, you asked me if I could try to reach out and get some maybe get some interviews, and you know, we kind of landed on this one. This one was sort of a gift, and you know, you didn't even have to let me be a part of it. I mean, you could have done it yourself, but I the amount of respect that I have for John, and you know the amount of respect that I have for John, it really meant the world to me. So thank you so much for allowing me to have the opportunity to, you know, just, you know, for my first interview to be something as iconic as that.
Well, I wouldn't have wanted it to be anything differently. But you can catch, this is Cage My IQ. You can catch all of our stuff before we get going on Twitter at Cage IQ, Facebook at Cage My IQ SB, and Instagram at Cage My IQ. And then whenever we go live on twitch.tv/CageMyIQ. And then we're also affiliated with the Sports Box, a great group of guys, over 20 podcasts of all different sports. And we just all talk, have a great time. We're in a group chat where we talk about things, get all the podcasts ready. But you can find all the handles for that in the outro that I'm going to be playing in a second. But we'd like to say thank you guys for tuning in. Leave us a comment on the video on YouTube. We'll get back to you. Anything you have to say, just let us know what you think of this. And I'm your host, D-Bake. This is my buddy, MMA Drunkie, a.k.a. Jay Henry. You guys have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you for watching this episode of Cage My IQ on the Sports Box. Please remember to follow us on all of our social media outlets. On Facebook at Sports Box Show, Twitter at Sports Box Show, Instagram at The Sports Box Show. Find us on YouTube and join Outside the Box, our Facebook sports discussion group. The Sports Box is brought to you by our sponsor, Showcase Sports in Hamilton. Showcase Sports, for the elite athlete. And also our friends over at CrowdPlay. Download the free CrowdPlay app today and use promo code THEBOX at sign up for 10 free points. Thank you for joining us.